It is Wednesday, January 15th, 2020. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you're tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon, and for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. House votes to send articles to Senate and approves seven members to serve as prosecutors in the impeachment trial. The 223-198 vote fell largely along party lines, with only one Democrat joining all the Republicans in opposition, and sets up what will be a highly partisan trial. Representative Colin Peterson, Democrat of Minnesota, who voted against both impeachment articles last month, was the lone defector. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi selected seven House members today to serve as impeachment managers in the upcoming Senate trial of President Trump, including Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff and Judiciary Committee Chairman Gerald Nadler. The Senate is preparing to begin President Trump's impeachment trial on Tuesday, a grueling process that senators expect will be highly partisan and likely drag on past the State of the Union address in early February. What are we to make of all of these developments? Well, for insight, we turn to my first guest. He's a writer and broadcaster. His new book as editor and contributor is titled Flashpoint in Ukraine: U.S. Drive for Hegemony Risks World War III. He is Stephen Lendman. Stephen Lendman, welcome to the Critical Hour.
Oh, Wilma, good to be on with you. Yes, this impeachment thing has been going on for some time, and it's amazing the way the major media reported is absolutely different than what this thing is all about. The key on this, Wilma, is not that I never call them Democrats, because there's nothing Democratic about them. I call them Dems or undemocratic Dems. Well, I'll just call them Dems for this my comments this afternoon. What the Dems really want is to weaken Trump, to give their own candidates, especially their presidential candidates, but congressional ones as well, an opportunity to retake the Congress. They've got the House. They hope to retake the Senate, and they want their own guy in the White House. And that's what this impeachment scam, and it is a scam, is all about. If they really wanted to go after Trump for crimes, they will go after him for crimes of war against humanity, breaching the public trust, and things along those lines. But, of course, they'd never do that because they're complicit in these crimes.
Well said, and you've pretty much summarized my position since this whole thing started. So today, Pelosi, she names Adam Schiff the lead impeachment manager, who's going to oversee the members arguing the Dems' case against Trump during the Senate trial. Your thoughts on the seven members that make up her team?
Well, I have nothing good to say about Adam Schiff. I haven't checked the other names. I know Nadler. I've quoted him a number of times. Probably other key people on the appropriate committees will be the ones that will be their prosecutors. And we know what's going to happen in the Senate, Wilma. The GOP-controlled Senate is going to throw this thing out. It simply will go nowhere. And it was designed, really, to go nowhere. I don't know how many days this thing will go on. It depends on Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, how many witnesses he's willing to call. He ought to go along with that and bring witnesses to bear on this. But they should call witnesses that are the kind of people. I mean, they can call the ones that the Dems want, but they should call the ones that they do not want, like Joe Biden and his son Hunter. I mean, these are two key people in the charges that the Dems are bringing against Trump. You bring these guys on, and you'll find out that they're guilty of wrongdoing. But as far as what went on between Trump and Ukraine, the president of Ukraine, Vladimir Zelensky, debunked them.
Looking at the other members of the committee, you've got Jerry Nadler of New York. You have Adam Schiff. You have Hakeem Jeffries from New York, Zoe Lofgren of California, Val Demings of Florida, Sylvia Garcia of Texas, and Jason Crow of Colorado. That's who Nancy Pelosi has selected. Are we to make anything of the fact that Schiff is over the Intelligence Committee, While the House Judiciary Committee, led by Nadler, has traditionally handled impeachment, is the Intelligence Committee leading this because of the international nature of this issue?
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think Schiff is a former prosecutor.
Yes, he is.
Am I wrong on that?
No, you're correct.
That's the reason he's doing it. I don't know what Nadler's background is, and I'm honestly not familiar with the other Dems. A couple of the names of a slight familiarity with, but I have no idea who they are. It's clear about one thing: they're all very strongly anti-Trump, so they're all on the same page going after him. But the way this thing was structured by Nancy Pelosi, it was really structured more to lose than to win. She rushed through the process. She didn't take enough time. She could have put together a stronger, even aside from the real crimes that Trump committed, she could have put together a much stronger case against Trump. But because she rushed things so much, she didn't do it. And she assured that this thing will go nowhere in the Senate. And of course, I think most of your listeners know, no U.S. president in U.S. history was ever removed from office by impeachment. A couple impeached, Johnson in the 18th century and Bill Clinton in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and they were acquitted in the Senate trial, and neither one of them should have been impeached on the charges that were brought against them.
Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell is saying that Republicans could subpoena Hunter Biden to testify about his business dealings with the Ukrainian gas company if Democrats insist on having witnesses such as John Bolton. Is that really a threat to the Democrats, or is that a threat that they're willing to absorb?
Well, I don't think they want to let either Joe Biden or Hunter Biden get anywhere near these proceedings. But if I were running, if I was Mitch McConnell, Joe Biden and his son Hunter would be the first two I would want to bring forth and get them under oath. I guess that's the way this thing will go, and just grill them, because there's so much that they did in Ukraine that really falls in the category of wrongdoing, showing that they're the ones that committed wrongdoing. Hunter Biden, he was involved in this corrupt gas company in Ukraine. He was on the board of directors. I think he really ever showed up to do anything. Mm. They paid him an awful lot of money. Hundreds of thousands of dollars. Exactly how much, I don't know. Maybe the true amount hasn't been revealed. Could be over $1 million. It's an awful lot of money for doing nothing, simply because his last name is Biden. That's the only reason. A son of the former vice president. And Joe Biden admitted in comments he made some months back, maybe last year or so, I forget the date. I don't think it was last year. I think it was earlier than that. But at the Council for Foreign Relations, he admitted that he threatened Vladimir Zelensky to fire the prosecutor that was looking into his son's dealings with the Burisma gas company, and he threatened to withhold something like $1 billion in U.S. Military aid to Ukraine unless he fired the prosecutor. And one of the comments he made at the CFR was, I don't remember it exactly, but I do remember the way he began it, saying, quote, "Son of a they fired the guy."
What a surprise. What a surprise.
What a surprise indeed.
So now with Bolton coming forward and Bolton saying that he is willing to testify if subpoenaed, does that put any additional pressure on Mitch McConnell as it relates to his willingness or unwillingness to call witnesses?
Well, that's a big unknown. Bolton said he quit, and Trump said he sacked him. I don't believe Trump on too much, but I believe he did sack him, and exactly why. I mean, he's got a bunch of extremists surrounding him. Pompeo was just as extremist as Bolton, so why fire Bolton and leave Pompeo as Secretary of State? If he wanted to get rid of bad guys, he should have gotten rid of both of them and the henchmen that worked for these people, but he only got rid of Bolton, and exactly what went on in their private conversations, I don't know. Maybe Bolton challenge Trump, where Pompeo sucks up to them. Maybe that's the reason that Bolton went and Pompeo stayed. But I don't know that Bolton would join with the Dems against Trump. He might say a few things that the Dems might like to hear, but I doubt that he would be the kind of witness that they want to go in against Trump. And I think when all is said and done, when this thing is over with, and it could be in days, or maybe they'll drag it out for a few weeks, simply don't know at this point, it will end up much ado about nothing.
There are now newly released materials showing the Ukraine prosecutor offering information related to Biden in exchange for the ouster of the ambassador. Will this have any impact going forward, again, with Bolton agreeing to testify? When I hear newly uncovered information at this stage of the game, I tend to question how newly uncovered the information is.
I honestly don't know, but what I do know is that the charges, the articles of impeachment against Trump, simply do not hold water. Now, that's the crux of the whole impeachment. Whatever they may bring backing them up, I don't know, just how damning they might be. I don't think they'll be damning enough, but the charges are really absurd. Abuse of power by seeking interference from Ukraine in the U.S. 2020 presidential election. Well, Ukrainian President Zelensky debunked the accusation. He publicly said there was no Trump blackmail threat, no quid pro quo, no conspiracy, nothing discussed between them about withholding U.S. aid for political reasons. So that article impeachment, they ought to bring Zelensky to testify, and I would imagine he would say the same thing. So that's an absurd charge against Trump. And the other one, obstruction of Congress, falsely claiming that he did, they quote, falsely claiming that Trump, quote, directed the unprecedented, categorical, and indiscriminate defiance of subpoenas issued by the House of Representatives pursuant to its sole power of impeachment, and then it added, without lawful cause or excuse, Trump directed the executive branch agencies for, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Oh, the bottom line on this was Trump remained unwilling to participate in the sham process, but he will participate in it. He'll comment on it. He will participate in it. And obstruction of Congress and abuse of power, simply the way the Dems are structuring it, they do not rise to the level of the charges against Trump. That's what it really comes down to. The charges are made, but the Dems have no evidence supporting this. And again, the President Zelensky on the first one, just debunking the whole idea.
Let me ask you, do you think that Zelensky is really between a rock and a hard place in that? How forthcoming do you think Zelensky would be willing to be knowing that, well, if there was any type of demand placed upon him, knowing that his money could be in jeopardy? Do you think that Zelensky is between a rock and a hard place, and how much trust can you put in his very vehement assertion that there was no demand made here?
Well, that's a legitimate point. I believe Zelensky made his comments in an interview, and I don't recall who it was with, maybe a Western media. I don't recall exactly. That's a legitimate point, but I tend to believe that. The Dems have presented no evidence indicating otherwise. They've made a lot of comments, but they haven't presented any evidence backing their claims. So I'll go with Zelensky rather than the Dems, unless they can present smoking gun evidence. But I doubt it exists, and I doubt it will come out in the Senate proceedings.
One of the pieces that came out today, according to this, these newly released materials, have to do with notes that were taken by some of Rudy Giuliani's operatives in Ukraine, one of which saying, get Zelensky to say that the investigation against Biden will be forthcoming. That's one of the new pieces that dropped today based upon these notes uncovered by one of Giuliani's operatives.
Yeah, I haven't followed what's going on today. I've been too involved in my writing about the Middle East. I had an appointment this morning that took a little bit of time, so I'm not aware of the newest stuff today. I did see something, headlines to the effect that the Dems have new bombshell information. Well, I mean, for all the time they've been at this, they've yet to come up with any bombshell information. So at the 11th hour, suddenly they're coming up with something. I doubt they've got anything that bombshell-like that is going to make much of a difference when the proceedings begin. When do they begin? On Thursday?
The reporting now is that they are supposed to begin on Tuesday. And one of the things that I have been saying since this whole thing started is the circumstantial nature of the Democrats' case, that up to this point, just about everything that they've presented is circumstantial. Now, we know in a court of law that circumstantial evidence sometimes can be more damning than direct evidence, but this is not a court of law. This is the court of public opinion. I think in a court of public opinion, you need to have some type of smoking gun. In fact, I'm looking now at this document from Lev Parnas, the former associate of Rudy Giuliani. This was released yesterday by House investigators. Get Zelensky to announce that the Biden case will be investigated. This is a note that Parnas, I guess, made to himself. And they are now touting this as evidence that they were pressuring Zelensky. And also following this was all done at the behest of the president.
Well, the Joe and Hunter Biden situation absolutely should be investigated, and there should be a lot of discussion about it to prove what sleazeballs these guys are. Hunter Biden would be a nobody if it wasn't for his daddy, and Biden was a despicable character throughout his political career, going back to the 1970s, mostly in the Senate in Delaware, and as vice president for 8 years. For people who don't like Trump, they certainly better hope that Biden does not become the guy who succeeds him. If that happens in November, we'll have to wait and see. As of now, Trump is the favorite to be reelected. But Biden is a despicable character. I have nothing good to say about Trump. The both of them are pretty despicable characters. And they're really on the same page when it comes to the big issues of supporting the military-industrial security complex and Wall Street and waging endless wars and so on and so forth. Biden also, from his history, is a racist, and it disturbs me greatly that in the black community he has very strong support, which he should not have, because he has a history of racism against black people, and black voters should really bone up on exactly what he's done in that regard in the U.S. Senate. That's where the racism was, voting for the wrong kind of laws that harm black people, and the black community really should go another way. Support Bernie Sanders. Support the only candidate I support is Tulsi Gabbard. I'm not a fan of Bernie Sanders, although he certainly would pick him over Biden, pick him over even Elizabeth Warren. I wrote a scathing article about her. I've written many scathing articles about Sanders, and I've written flattering articles about Gabbard, at the same time stressing that she's not perfect, and there are some things that she's done and has supported that I disagree with. But overall, she's got a terrific agenda, and I would love to see her be the Dem candidate and defeating Trump in November. But of course, the chances of that is zero.
Stephen Lindman, thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having you back. And thank you for giving us time today. I know time for you today is very precious. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Wilma. Good to be on with you.
Thank you. All right, folks, you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Democrats clash over positions on war and peace, as well as gender in politics. A whittled-down field of Democratic presidential candidates last night focused on their shared disdain for President Trump and elaborated on a host of policy differences, domestic and foreign, in the Iowa presidential debate. whose most animated moment turned out to be whether the debate on a woman could become president. What are we to make of all of this? Were there any valuable takeaways from last night's debate? Well, for insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's a Republican strategist, Malik Abdul. Welcome back to the Critical Hour.
And you pronounced it right.
Oh, well, I've been practicing.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us. Before we get to that, let me just quickly get your take. The House voted today 223 to 198, basically along party lines. You had one Democrat from Minnesota, Colin Peterson, who voted with the Republicans against impeachment. The Democrats walking the articles over to the Senate at 5 today. Your thoughts on where we are now?
Hey, I'd say it's about time. You know, fortunately, there doesn't seem like that Nancy Pelosi, you know, a lot of the things that we were talking about leading up to today was that, you know, she was a powerhouse and she was going to actually get some movement on things. But really, it doesn't seem like she got any concessions from the Senate at all, which is something that we really should have expected. But it's kind of interesting that they're really making the same process argument that Republicans were making during the House impeachment hearings.
Do you think, as much as I'm sure Nancy Pelosi would have wanted to get concessions from Mitch McConnell up front, do you think that if witnesses are allowed to be called, that she will then be able to say it worked in the end?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I mean, if there are, you know, they've decided that they're going to do the first part, and that will just be from, we know, with the impeachment managers going back and forth presenting their case. And then after that, what I've heard is that they're going to then consider whether or not more witnesses are needed. Now, if they get to the end of this and they decide that, oh, wow, well, we need more witnesses, then, yeah, I would have to concede that that would be a win for Nancy Pelosi. But they are, from what I understand, they are really modeling what happened in 98, I think it was,
right,
with Clinton's impeachment.
And Mitch McConnell would say to her, well, I told you this is what I was going to do anyway, so I don't know why you're making all this noise. So now, back to last night's debate, your thoughts on what you saw?
Just say, wow. I mean, you know, if this is what the Democrats have to offer so far, I think we can pretty much just go ahead and get the balloons and stuff ready for the inauguration of Trump once again. You know, I see a lot of people are really complaining about, you know, this substance of, you know, the substance of the show, but it was about domestic and foreign policy. And so I think from that perspective, to really have the candidates in a smaller, on a smaller state, well, with smaller, fewer people on the stage, I think it was great to have them actually really talk about foreign policy, because we really haven't heard a lot about that. And if you really dig down into it, they are not too far off from where the administration is. Not at all. And so I think that if you listen to, you know, the questions about what would you do, you know, are we going to leave forces, things like that, you know, it's kind of what you would expect from, you know, the opposite party. But overall, I just don't think that this moved the needle that much in the Democrats' favor as far as defeating Donald Trump. Now, in your lead-in, you mentioned that one point, and I don't know if you wanted to talk about that now, but the thing that really stood out to me was that moment between Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren on the question of, did you make those comments about, you know, did you question whether or not a woman could win?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting, but I was kind of, you know, it blew my mind in a sense when Abby didn't follow up with Elizabeth, you know, Senator Warren's question, you know, her comments that she made in response to it, because it was pretty much a deflection. So you had, on one hand, Bernie Sanders was pretty, you know, direct. He said no.
Bernie was Bernie. He answered the question.
Absolutely. And he didn't deflect. He answered the question. No ifs, ands, buts about it. But then Elizabeth, well, you know, Senator Warren, which was interesting because you could tell that she had prepared for that question, because she immediately pivoted to women.
Right.
And not that that's not a good thing to talk about, but in response to a direct question about an accusation that you made, you would think you would say, well, you know what, Bernie? Yeah, you kind of said that. But she didn't say it at all, which leads me to believe that Elizabeth Warren may have stretched the truth again about this particular issue. But it was just weird. And the follow-up for, you know, when Abby moved to Senator Warren asking her the question, she led in her question saying, well, do you disagree with what Bernie said about women? And I was like,
No. Hold up, Malik. That's not what she said. What she said, what Abby said, and I was very disappointed in her saying this, she said, how did you feel?
Yes.
When Senator Sanders said that to you, she totally ignored Bernie's
the denial.
And what she should have said was, Senator Warren, your response. That's what she should have said.
Quick and easy. That would have, you know, it was pretty, you know, that was pretty open and closed at that point. She pivoted it to her, but she didn't do that at all. And you're correct. That's exactly what she said. Asking her how she felt about comments that Senator Sanders had denied. So it was very weird that that was her transition. And she didn't bother to follow up nor ask, because if you remember when Bernie, you know, after Bernie had denied it, Abby came back and asked again. So just so I'm clear, Senator Sanders, you were saying that this, you know, essentially you're saying that this conversation, you know, that you did not make those remarks. But when with Senator Warren, there was no follow-up at all. And so Senator Warren had that canned moment where she was able to talk about women and being one of, you know, all of the women on stage and everything. That, to me, was a very weird moment. And I don't know. Yeah, that was a very weird moment.
You know, to your point about the foreign policy discussion and that the Democrats really, there's not a lot of daylight between most of the Democrats on the panel and the current administration, I think you're absolutely right. For example, there was no discussion about Venezuela, and we've had Nancy Pelosi come out and say that Trump's move on Venezuela was the right thing to do. And we also know that that is not really Trump policy. That came through the Obama administration, and the attacks of Venezuela started with the Bush administration. There was no discussion of what's going on in Bolivia. And Elizabeth Warren is on record as having said that the move on Bolivia was a good move. So I find it very troubling that on one hand, Nancy Pelosi can talk about protecting democracy. We need to impeach the president to protect democracy. But then you're okay with coup d'etats in Latin American countries that have democratically elected leaders. That to me, and then not to mention Barack Obama did assassinate Muammar Gaddafi at the behest of Hillary Clinton. So when it comes to these types of actions, there is hardly any daylight between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Yeah, and you know, and when it comes to foreign policy, generally speaking, you have your hawks and your doves, you know, and I don't know. I think Trump is kind of in the middle of that. I don't know what that middle ground is, but he's not a war hawk in the John Bolton sense.
Pompeo sense.
Yes, Pompeo sense. But it was, you find these type of discussions where you're kind of getting into, you know, what they boiled it down to was that, well, you know, I don't think that we should have, and it was interesting how they phrased that. You know, the question about whether or not we should, you know, troops should remain in Syria or things like that. You know, of course, people are going to say, well, no, of course, our troops need to come home. You know, everyone says that. Even Trump says that. Barack Obama says that. George Bush said that. Everyone says that. But it's right. I mean, there's not a lot of daylight there. And seems like a lot of the meat really is more so about foreign policy, because I don't think you're going to have many politicians who are going to take really like a Bernie Sanders or AOC approach as far as, you know, our foreign intervention. You know, some people are just, you know, get us out. Or I should say on the Republican side, a Rand Paul, you know.
Right.
So you're not going to have many people take that Rand Paul approach to our foreign policy.
I was surprised last night that Senator Sanders they talked about how much the healthcare initiatives cost. They talked about and how difficult and how unaffordable the healthcare initiative, how unaffordable the free college tuition initiatives are. But I didn't hear any rebuttal on, look at how much we're spending in these wars. Look at how much this defense budget is costing us. And look at how really unsafe it is making us. I was really disappointed that Bernie did not toe a harder line on, look, folks, you've got to really readjust your sights here and understand what's important, understand what isn't important, what makes us safe, and what continues to threaten us. I was disappointed that he did not stake a higher claim there.
And that's his bread and butter. I mean, if you think of someone, you know, he continuously reminds us that he voted against the Iraq War. And so he uses that as a platform to really be that anti-war candidate concerned about, you know, let's be more concerned about what's happening here domestically than our foreign intervention. But you're right. There literally was nothing about that coming from Bernie Sanders, which made, you know, I kind of thought at that point, I said, well, if he's elected, which I don't think is going to happen, but if he's elected, I wonder whether...
Wait a minute. Let me be sure I understand what you.
Don't think that's going to happen.
No, let me be sure I understand what you mean by that. Do you mean if he gets the nomination, or do you mean if he becomes president?
Well, good point, because he has to get the nomination first.
Yeah. So what do you mean by that?
So if he happens to get the nomination,
okay,
and then eventually becomes president,
okay,
I don't think that he would have, and I don't think that our military apparatus, you know, you have a lot of pie in the sky feelings about, well, let's get out. Our current president, you know, he was, well, let's get out of Afghanistan. You know, Barack Obama got us in there and we should get all of our troops out of this place or that place. Well, if you look at him now, and even if you look at what happened in Syria, where he decided that when John Bolton resigned, and I think that was Syria, where he was going to remove troops from Syria, but then he doubled back and said, okay, well, we're going to have a smaller force there. So even Donald Trump is not this big, you know, he can say whatever he said before becoming president, but I think the realities of being president, once that hits you and you have people around you, and, you know, not every person who becomes president is a foreign policy expert. And so you rely on the people around you to feed you information. And I think, just as it was with Trump, that if Bernie Sanders ends up winning the nomination and becoming president, Bernie Sanders would probably take a similar approach to what Trump has taken, because the argument that the experts around him will be saying that this is for our national security.
That is the one point. I say this not endorsing any candidate or not suggesting anybody vote for a particular candidate, but when I listen to their presentations and when I listen to their logic, Bernie Sanders on most issues makes a whole lot of sense.
Absolutely.
And my question, if I get a chance to interview Senator Sanders, my question to him would be, if you become president, how are you going to be able to withstand the pressure put upon you that every other president faces from those that support the military-industrial complex, from the deep state? How are you going to be able to weather that storm and not succumb to the pressure that... Now, one thing that he might say is that many of his predecessors, they weren't speaking how they truly felt during the campaign, that they were more hawkish than they wanted to lead the country to believe. I put Barack Obama in that camp. And so he might say that, but then he would be criticizing his predecessors, which presidents don't do.
Yes.
So I just wonder, Bernie, how are you going to be able to hold your ground when the generals come in and say, we need you to push a button here so we can get this war going?
Yeah, and I think I just said it a minute ago when you're talking about the realities of being president. I think once you're hit with those harsh realities, you know, you have to end up changing your view. Barack Obama, and we all know, as someone who voted for him, I should say, that Barack Obama, his claim to fame, remember, I think it was, what, in 2004 at the DNC convention,
mm-hmm.
where he talked about being against the Iraq war. You know, that
right.
was, and he ran a campaign talking about we need to get out of these endless wars and intervention here and there, but then he became president of the United States.
And doubled down in Libya and exacerbated the situation.
Sure did.
Making it exponentially worse. Warren and Buttigieg, they clashed on health care. Your thoughts on that discussion?
Well, I think that Senator Warren, her plan, and it wasn't just Buttigieg, it was a previous debate where people started really like digging into
right.
Senator Warren about her plan.
And saying her numbers don't add up.
Yeah, and the cost of her plan. Bernie Sanders actually admitted that, hey, yeah, middle class taxes, they're probably going to go up.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a realistic way. I'm not sure,
Wait a minute. Finish the thought. What he said was, your taxes are going to go up, but you're going to save costs in these other places.
That's what he said. You're right. And that's a fair assessment of exactly what he said. But with Warren and Buttigieg, I think Warren's strategy at this point really is to kind of kick Buttigieg down the ladder a bit. Because some of her, you know, approaches that she was taking and even the questions about the health care, you know, I'm someone who personally, I like all of the candidates, but I definitely like Pete Buttigieg.
Mm-hmm.
Just his disposition, if nothing else. You know, I appreciate his disposition and knowing his experience, or as some people would argue, his lack of experience, that he holds the line. I mean, and he actually, you know, takes care of himself. But that health care debate, I think that people would be more likely to listen to Buttigieg than Warren on that, because I really think that she damaged herself early on, where you had people pushing back on those numbers. You know, it sounds great in theory, but how are you going to pull it off? And just by saying that I have X number of years in office and all of that type of stuff, well, that type of stuff doesn't get policies passed. And so,
right.
But I think that at the end of the day, Buttigieg ends up getting the better end of that argument, even though the idea of Medicare for all and things like that, I just don't think it's going to work. But I think because Buttigieg is a bit more moderate, well, not a bit, he's more moderate than Warren on a lot of those issues, he ends up being the victor.
Wow. Well, Malik Abdul, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate your analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Absolutely, brother. Take care.
You too, man. All right, folks. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Iran rejects idea of new, quote, Trump deal, end quote, in nuclear row. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani dismissed today a proposal for a new Trump deal aimed at resolving this nuclear conflict, saying it was a strange offer and criticizing U.S. President Trump for always breaking promises. What are we to make from these latest discussions? Well, for insight, we turn to my next guest. He's a U.S.-Palestinian journalist, media consultant, and author, a columnist and editor of Palestine Chronicle, former managing editor of Middle East Eye, and former deputy managing editor of Al Jazeera Online, Dr. Ramzi Baroud. Welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also joined by an American sociologist and specialist in comparative historical sociology. He's a professor at the University of Albany SUNY. He is best known as the author of the book Capitalists in Spite of Themselves, which has been awarded several prizes, including the American Sociological Association Distinguished Scholarly Book Award. Professor Richard Lachman. Professor Lachman, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who has praised President Trump as a great deal maker, yesterday called for the president to replace Iran's 2015 nuclear deal with major powers with his own new pact to ensure Tehran does not get an atomic weapon. Trump said he agreed with Johnson that a Trump deal should replace the Iran nuclear deal. Let me start with you, Dr. Baroud. Your thoughts on Boris Johnson getting involved in this and making this proposal?
I think it's very clear that the West, particularly the European Union part of that deal, is now realizing that it has failed in terms of its ability to mediate and to breathe life into the deal that really was rendered irrelevant as soon as the United States pulled out. For years now, we have been kind of living in this kind of very strange political zone where the European Union has failed to fulfill its obligations under the deal, and it's really unable to rectify the damage created by the U.S. withdrawal. And it seems to me that with the latest escalations that happened as a result of the U.S. assassination of the Iranian commander Soleimani, it's becoming clear, I think, that Europe is realizing that it has failed and it has to make choices. And naturally, the choices, as if we are students of history, the choices are not going to be of, you know, finding common sense and returning to the United Nations and to the international community to find a way out, but rather to side with Washington. And who is the best person for that job is Boris Johnson. I think from the minute that Johnson kind of got involved in this, it means that there has been much of backroom dealings going on between Washington and London, and this is all happening in coordination between the Trump administration and the Johnson administration.
Just to be clear before I go to Professor Lachman, when you talk about the deal failing when the U.S. pulled out, did the deal fail because the U.S. pulled out, or did the deal fail because the U.S. pulled out and then imposed sanctions or threatened to impose sanctions on the EU countries if they continued to deal with Iran?
Oh, absolutely. And in fact, the late of such threats, what happened only recently when Trump threatened that he is going to add more tariffs to the, you know, auto contracts between Europe and the United States. So not only did the U.S. pull out, and we understand that the U.S. is the most, you know, critical party
right
in that deal outside of Iran, but the fact that the U.S. kind of followed that with several aggressive steps aimed at punishing anyone who would dare engage Iran.
Professor Lachman, same questions to you.
Well, I think Boris Johnson's motive is that now that Britain's leaving the EU, he's very eager to get a trade deal with the United States. And he thinks by providing this service for Trump of proposing a new Iran deal, he'll somehow get a better trade deal with the United States. But I mean, the real problem is that Trump is not consistent. You know, he's not somebody who keeps his word. So the Iranian president was quite right to say we can't negotiate a deal as long as Trump's president. And I think, you know, after 4 or 8 years of Trump and with the experience of George W. Bush before that, that more and more countries in the world are just going to decide accurately that they can't rely on the United States, that the word of the United States isn't worth very much, and that these countries are going to try to figure out how they can order their economic and diplomatic affairs involving the United States as little as possible. That's going to be the legacy of Trump.
Following up there, Professor Lachman, do you think that Boris Johnson was really, in making this proposal, playing more to Trump's ego than really putting forth something that he thought would actually fly? Because I can't think of anybody in their right mind who would think that making a proposal like this to Iran, that it would actually get considered. This thing to me would seem to be DOA, dead on arrival. So do you think that Johnson said, oh, yeah, okay, Donald, I'll go ahead and make this idea. Yeah, this Trump plan is a brilliant idea and the best idea ever thought of by mankind. And now Donald Trump is happy with Boris Johnson.
Yes, I think that's entirely it. I mean, whatever else Johnson is, he's not stupid. And he, I think, certainly knows that this proposal is not going to go anywhere, that it's not the basis for a negotiation.
In a televised speech, President Rouhani told Washington to return to the nuclear pact, which Washington abandoned in 2018, under which Tehran had curbed its nuclear work in return for the lifting of international sanctions. There are a few odd things here to me. First, again, Boris Johnson making this proposal and this whole Trump deal, it's almost as though Trump just wants his name on the thing the same way he updated NAFTA with claiming now to have cast this NAFTA in a brand new light. But we all really know that it's pretty much the same terms, just slightly updated. So, Dr. Baru, do you think that, this really just seems to be Trump just trying to put his stamp on something because he has really nothing of his own to propose?
That could possibly be it, but we have to consider the Israeli role in this. The U.S. pulled out of the nuclear deal with Iran in 2018 after relentless pressure from the pro-Israel lobby in Washington, D.C., and Israel, the Israeli government in Tel Aviv. And it was made very clear that we are doing this for the sake of Israel, not anything else. Therefore, I don't think this is business as usual, as let's just rebrand an existing deal and put Trump's stamp on it and just say, this is an American-led initiative. I think there is a different scenario here. Now, let's just say, for the sake of argument, that this is indeed what it is. From Iran's point of view, it would be absolutely impossible. It would be a complete and utter political defeat for Tehran to concede, to enter through all of these years of pressures and humiliations and sanctions that resulted in the nuclear deal in 2015, only to be reneged by the U.S. 3 years later, and only to be rebranded by the U.S. and for Iran to follow suit. As the professor has said earlier, at this point, not only Iran does not trust Trump, but it doesn't trust the United States government altogether, regardless of who is presiding over the government in Washington. So this is for Iran. This is they are in a corner here. They can't possibly concede, and they can't possibly trust the European Union. I mean, the fact that Britain, France, and Germany just yesterday, I believe, or the day before, just activated the dispute mechanism, it's their way of saying, let's renegotiate. And this is why I don't think Johnson's move is entirely independent from Germany and France. I think there is some coordination happening within these European countries that are involved in shaping the Iran deal. And this is why Iran is outraged and feel truly betrayed, because they truly hoped that the EU is going to deliver on its promises to the credit line of $15 billion, to lessen the effect of the sanctions. And they played that game for years. And the result is now the EU is moving away from it. They activated the dispute mechanism. Johnson is saying, let's put the ball back in the American court. So now Iran really needs its allies in Russia and in China and elsewhere. And I really think it's a matter of time before the entire Iran treaty is just behind us.
Professor Lackman, same question to you.
Yeah, I think this is a case where the U.S. will never take yes for an answer. Back during the George W. Bush administration, Iran approached the United States and stated it was willing to abandon any nuclear program and to make all sorts of other concessions to the United States. And the Bush administration refused to negotiate. They don't want to have a peaceful arrangement with Iran. The United States responds to the interests of Israel, to the interests of Saudi Arabia, and also to fanatics within Republican administrations like Secretary of State Pompeo. And so there's really nothing that Iran can offer. And, you know, this talk of a more comprehensive deal is something that Iran can't rely on, that even if they were to make these huge concessions, they wouldn't get a stable deal with the United States. You know, most likely the U.S. would ask for more or just reject that.
Let's go back to the point about the EU enacting or threatening to enact or charge Iran with violating the deal. That makes absolutely no sense to me, since the United States is the one that walked away from the deal. And Iran seems, by all reporting, to have done everything under its power to stay within the parameters of the deal, but they really now seem to have been backed into a corner. So how is it now that the EU can enact sanctions based upon the deal for violation against Iran, Dr. Baroud?
Of course, you're absolutely right when you said it doesn't make any sense. None of this makes any sense. I'm not a defender of Iran, but the fact is, if you look at the trajectory of the nuclear deal, you would find that from the start, there was a great deal of unfairness in the way that Iran was treated, despite the fact that they clearly put sincere efforts forward. And, you know, just the fact that they allowed the International Atomic Energy Agency for years to look into their business, to come to Iran, to inspect numerous sites. That's even before the nuclear deal was signed in the first place. So that wasn't even a gesture of goodwill. That was a mechanism that was in place even prior to that. The idea in Iran, among Iranian, within the Iranian government and intelligentsia, is that, and that is an idea that has been promoted by the kind of more conservative streak within the Iranian government, is that you can't trust the West. The more moderate, the Rouhani camp, has always believed that, yes, but the West is not one unified political unit, and you can talk to the EU. You can engage European Union, and maybe we can actually break this kind of unity between North America or between the United States and the European Union. And sadly, this theory has been proven wrong. The fact that now the U.S. Treasury Secretary just argued that now that the EU is arguing against or is going to consider the fact that Iran supposedly violated the deal. Let's go back to the United Nations, the U.S. wants. And let's go back to the United Nations and let's snap back the sanctions into place. That's his exact terminology. So now Iran feels complete betrayal by everybody involved in this. And I don't know what would be the next steps for Iran at this point. They are still arguing that the deal stands, maybe because they don't have any political or diplomatic alternative. But on the other hand, you don't know how long it's going to be before the conservative element within the Iranian government to come and say enough is enough and we have to do what is right for our country, as opposed to, you know, being sold yet more false hope by the Europeans that things are going to eventually turn out to be okay.
Professor Lachman, days before Europeans warned Iran of nuclear deal violations, Trump secretly threatened to impose 25% tariff on European autos if they didn't. If they refused to call out Tehran and initiate an arcane dispute mechanism in the deal, the United States would impose a 25% tariff on European automobiles, the administration warned, this according to European officials. Again, same question to you. How is it that anyone in their right mind could try to initiate a dispute mechanism against a deal that Iran did not violate?
Yeah, no, it's certainly absurd. And, you know, the Europeans have decided that they have more need to be able to export autos to the U.S. and not anger Trump than to be fair with Iran or to maintain diplomatic relations with Iran. And, you know, I think on some level, they probably think Iran, in fact, won't build a nuclear weapon, you know, because Iran is going to be worried about provoking an attack from the United States or Israel. And so the important thing is, with the end of the deal, any sort of reconciliation between the United States and Iran is over. And there really isn't any role for Europe to play. You know, they weren't willing to take the risk of U.S. sanctions by buying Iranian oil. They kept promising Iran that they'd find some way to be able to buy oil from Iran, but they haven't accomplished that. And, you know, they're not willing to take any risk to maintain this deal. And so, you know, it's not like they were reasonable up till this moment, and now they're filing absurd charges of violation against Iran. They weren't willing to take any risks or pay any costs to try to maintain this deal.
We have just about 2 minutes left, a minute for each of you. Let me ask you, Dr. Barood, how damaging, and you've alluded to this in some of your earlier statements, but going forward, whether Trump is reelected or if someone else is elected in the 2020 election, how damaging is this from a foreign policy perspective for the United States going forward?
I think the U.S. Under the Trump administration has done many other steps, whether in the climate treaty or the Iran treaty and course, the Middle East peace process and so forth. They have done so much to discredit themselves and to withdraw from any position or at least any claim at leadership in the Middle East and beyond the Middle East. And I think whomever is going to be the new president, if Trump is not reelected again, I think it's going to be a lot of work, you know, considering that there is a degree of sincerity, a lot of work to rectify some of that damage. And I think the Iran deal is a case in point.
And same question to you, Professor Lackman. How damaging for U.S. diplomacy going forward do you see this being?
Well, I think it's damaging, first of all, in the way that we've been talking about, that countries can't trust the word of the United States. But also it is empowering the most aggressive elements in Israel and Saudi Arabia, that they're essentially being told the United States is going to try to crush Iran, and that they're able to take whatever steps they'd like to in the Middle East. So it's disruptive, not just for the U.S. presence in the world, but within the Middle East, that this deal that Obama negotiated was a basis for sort of balance and a de-escalation of confrontation in the Middle East, and that's been lost now.
Professor Richard Lackman, Dr. Ramzi Barood, gentlemen, thank you both for your time today. Thank you for your analysis. Look forward to having the both of you back.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you, and thank you for having a discussion on this.
Thank you. Thank you. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Peace and blessings. I'm out.